indifference towards women's rights to education, equal pay, suitable jobs, respect and social rights, and most of all, protection against domestic violence. Of course, perhaps these women's anger was more towards the laws that did not have their back rather than their husbands. Women who were beaten at home by their husbands for different reasons, yet the law only supported them up until the door of their house. The law's excuse for this was not to intervene in the citizens' private affairs. Thus, when it came to the house, it was the men who made the law. The battered women would cover up their bruised faces with makeup, and there weren't many who were much inclined to speak about the things that happened to them inside the house.
Okay, let's go, my arm.
The men, on the other hand, did not shy away from violence towards their wives, due to the free pass the culture and law gave them in this regard. The women of America demanded rights to education, payment, and security.
Equal rights to set forth our own humanity, equal rights to get into graduate programs, to get into schools, to training programs. We're the bottom third of the employment in terms of pay. We represent nonetheless 34% of the workforce, yet we're the first to be laid off and the last to be hired. There aren't frivolous demands at all. We just want what men have had all these years.
This issue did not belong to past centuries. This is the United States of America of 1970. Although protests against domestic violence intensified during the second half of 1970, husbands abusing their wives and justifying their actions had roots in times as far as the first American immigrants who settled in those lands. When the first immigrants arrived in this region, they started to write laws for their newly founded America by forming a government. The first settlers of America took their law from the common law derived from the traditional rules of the British judicial system. Common law originated in England in the Middle Ages and was applied in British colonies across the continents. According to this law, a man had the right to punish his wife if needed. In 1982, an important event took place that marked the beginning of a review in the issue of domestic violence against women. Tracy Thurman, a housewife in the city of Torrington. First, in October 1982, Charles, Thurman's husband, had a fight with her and threw her out of the house. Tracy went to the police department, but the police did not handle her case because there was no law to support her. A month later, it happened again. This time, Charles, Tracy's husband, broke the car window on her while she was sitting in the car. Tracy's body was covered with broken glass. This time, because the crime happened outside the house, the police got involved, and the court issued a restraining order against Charles for 2 years. However, during this period of 2 years, Charles repeatedly violated the court's order, and each time Tracy's complaint did not result in anything. Charles even threatened to kill her once, but the police did not do anything about it. A few months later, when Tracy was at home with her child, her husband Charles entered their residence. Tracy called the police. Charles stabbed Tracy's neck, throat, and chest with a knife. At this moment, a police officer arrived, but Charles, without fear, kicked Tracy in the head with another hard blow. Tracy was now lying on the ground in her own blood, but the police still did not react. Charles was about to attack Tracy, who was sleeping on the stretcher of the emergency team. But this time, the police stopped watching and finally arrested Charles after he had inflicted multiple stabbings and hittings to Tracy's head several times. Tracy Thurman spent 8 months in the hospital. Some of her body parts were temporarily and others permanently paralyzed. This time, instead of suing her husband, Tracy sued the police department for not supporting and defending her. Now, women's slogans had become more uniform and coherent. Women unite. Don't let racism divide us. Girls are powerful. The rise of women's protests against men's violence, along with the liberal slogans, marked yet another event. Feminist movements were gradually born, and protests against the inferior status of women and the violence they endured at home began in the American society. American states, one by one, began to repeal the laws that allowed men to punish women. The US government, maintaining that a man's home is his castle, had traditionally been reluctant to police the confines of the home. Moreover, many legal authorities insisted on blaming the victim and believed that the wife was partially responsible for her beating by provoking her husband and making him angry. American laws allowed a man to punish a woman under the pretext of reforming her. The courts only considered the complaint of a beaten woman if the woman was severely injured during the beating by her husband. However, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was approved by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris on December 10, 1948, said something else. Article 1 of the Declaration. All human beings are born free and are equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood.
Approved by an overwhelming majority. The Declaration of Human Rights as a standard of conduct for all. And let us, as members of the United Nations, conscious of our own shortcomings and imperfections, join our effort in good faith to live up to this high standard.
But women were still deprived of such a right in America. Violence against women was considered normal. This normality can be understood in a joke that was broadcast on the BBC radio in the same years. A woman asks another why she feels her husband doesn't love her anymore. She hears the answer, "He hasn't beaten me in a week or two." Little by little, various organizations started to deal with the domestic violence against women under the title of non-governmental organizations. The law changed. But the culture of violence against women still carries on. The slogan of gender equality gradually made women own rights that might have been funny to think about in the United States a few decades ago. In addition to the right to vote and the right to employment and equal wages, they now had the right to wear clothes. They could decide for the life or death of the fetus inside their womb, or they could even have other kinds of freedom in sexual issues. But did helpless women really join feminism movements to achieve such freedoms? Apparently, everything has benefited women, but there is still a problem. Women were still beaten by men. Liberalism. It reinforced racism, classism, and other forms of oppression. Women were now oppressed again, but this time this oppression was not only from their husbands. Every man who had the chance to communicate with that woman would provide the basis for this, with sexual harassment and physical violence. These are official statistics from within the United States. Every year, about 500,000 people in America are victims of sexual violence, including 12-year-old children. However, 90% of the people who were raped are adult women. 2022. According to statistics, one out of every three women in the United States has experienced violence from her husband or partner. About 20,000 calls are made to the domestic violence help centers every day. And on the other end of the line are people who have been beaten or threatened with death by their spouses or partners. The phenomenon of violence against women in the United States may not be at the top of the world news like that of third world countries, but this does not mean that violence against women does not exist in the States. According to statistics from the National Office on Domestic Violence, one woman is battered every 9 seconds in the United States. Florida State Senator Janet Cruz's report is worth considering.
In Florida, there were 106,000 reported domestic violence offenses in 2020. And that was including more than 200 domestic violence murders.
This log home at Big Lake was one of Bree Moore's favorite places.
Her formal name is Brianna, but as she got older, she wanted to be called Bree.
Her parents say they can still feel her presence here.
She would get me up early in the morning and say, "Dad, come on, we've got to go ride. She made every minute out of her life special.
Police told the Moores their daughter's body was found at her boyfriend's home, where he lived with his parents. The Moores asked if there had been a home invasion.
They said no. They said Josh, her boyfriend, killed her.
Bree would be the last. Years later, what really was happening with Josh and in his history, this was really the inevitable.
But at the time, Bree seemed so devoted to her boyfriend, busy at her job as an aide in a dentist's office. But behind her smile, Bree's coworkers saw signs of trouble, signs they didn't reveal to the Moores until after her death.
They told me that she had come in several times with black eyes, and one time she came in and she hadn't just been hit, they said she had been beaten. And she couldn't function, and she vomited in the sink, and she left after about 15 minutes, they sent her home.
There were other red flags.
Well, I'll read you a text message that we found on Bree's phone after we got her phone back 2.5 years after she was killed. Bree texts, "You better love me and stop hitting me, please," with an exclamation point. "Josh, of course I love you, and Ramrod hit you, not I." So Ramrod must have been, you know, when he got angry, I'm assuming.
Nadine M. Newfoyle, director of the Department of Violence Against Women at the U.S. Department of Justice, says, "Based on our findings in the United States, every day, three women in this country are murdered by their spouse or ex-partner. This statistic is very alarming for us." Nadine M. Newfoyle's story is not the story of primitive African tribes or so-called third world countries. This is the United States of America in the year 2022. The 21st century, the cradle of freedom and democracy.
Because Brandy's case reminded Guard of Anitra Coburn.
Carter kidnapped Anitra and eventually took her to her grandparents' trailer in Franklin County.
Coburn's boyfriend kidnapped her from her Pitt County home and murdered her after holding her hostage for a week.
Half a century has passed since the protests of American women in 1970. And now, domestic violence has the voice of Angelina Jolie, a Hollywood star who was also once a victim.
Most of all, I want to acknowledge the children who are terrified and suffering at this moment, and the many people for whom this legislation comes too late.
A bipartisan group of U.S. senators has introduced a proposal to reauthorize a 1990s law that expands protections for victims of domestic and sexual violence. This law was dissolved in 2019 due to the opposition of Republicans, which has led to the promotion and increase of violence and murder in American society. Angelina Jolie asks U.S. senators to approve this law and says, "I repeat, this is one of the most important votes you will cast in the Senate this year." When silence comes from a Congress too busy to renew the Violence Against Women Act after a decade, it reinforces that sense of worthlessness. It's clear that the indifference of the Congress and the American government has troubled the 47-year-old Oscar winner. This was the third time that Angelina asked the representatives of the U.S. Congress to revise the law to control domestic violence. This law was first sent to the Senate in 1990 by Joe Biden, who was then a senator, with the aim of reducing domestic and sexual violence. A later version was included in a bill signed by then-President Bill Clinton 4 years later. Congress has since reauthorized and extended the Violence Against Women Act 3 times.
Senator Joe Biden invited them to speak.
Battered women need to be taken seriously. Proper police response can prevent what happened to me from happening to someone else. Thank you.
Thank you.
The story of domestic violence in the United States and the law to deal with it is a paraphrase of the saying, "The law often shows its teeth, but does not bite." The United States has moved away from the slogan of creating equal conditions and ideal and happy life for women. In a way, this shows America cannot be a good model for other societies. Feminist slogans try to make women equal to men in all matters. For example, the society should witness that women are beaten less. But why did feminism and women's movements target the family to achieve this goal? It was already known that a woman without a family would be disarmed, and that's how it happened. In practice, women still did not get their real rights. Until yesterday, they were under male violence at home, but today, they are under the domination of employers and cheap forces. They are now also responsible for financing themselves, a task that, at least in the distant years, was the responsibility of men. A century has passed from the American women's efforts to escape domestic violence and achieve equality. Yet domestic violence still takes 3 victims every day. Families are broken. Women are employed in menial jobs. And the salary and benefit system still consider women as second-hand labor. Kindergartens have expanded, but next to girls' high schools, right beside unmarried mothers. Joni Ernst, a Republican senator, is also a victim of sexual and domestic violence.
diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The researchers have found that, in most years, influenza, especially the H5N1 variant, was reported at the highest frequency of any infectious disease. 776 outbreaks have been documented since 1996. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote in this regard, the World Health Organization's disease reports reflect public health priorities and surveillance capabilities. Globally, influenza has been responsible for more outbreaks than any other infectious disease over the past 23 years, followed by respiratory syndrome, MERS, and Ebola, finds an analysis of disease reports by the World Health Organization, WHO. The study also reveals the subjective way in which disease outbreaks are often reported, suggesting that this can affect how resources are allocated. Public health authorities use several data sources to track infectious disease outbreaks, but the WHO's Disease Outbreak News, DON, is one of the most influential. Global health researcher Rebecca Katz at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and her colleagues collected all 2,789 DON reports issued between 1996 and 2019 in a searchable database. The database includes the metadata pulled from each report, such as the location of the outbreak, type of disease, and time frame over which it progressed. The researchers found that in most years, influenza, especially the H5N1 variant, was reported at the highest frequency of any infectious disease. 776 outbreaks have been documented since 1996. Saudi Arabia, which documented MERS 179 times, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo reported 105 Ebola outbreaks. Kat says the diversity in reporting patterns results from the disparate surveillance capacities of various countries, along with the diseases that national health authorities prioritize, and ultimately what the WHO decides to concern itself with. There are a lot of humans involved here, and humans are making different calls, she says. For instance, Ebola is reported much more often than other hemorrhagic fevers that periodically erupt in Africa. Other variations can be explained by the quality of the country's health systems. For example, Egypt has reported 115 outbreaks, mostly of influenza. In the 23-year time span that CATS team analyzed, but no outbreaks have ever been reported by nearby Libya, which has an underfunded and unstable health system as a result of the two civil wars during that period. Timothy Brewer, an infectious disease researcher at the University of California, Los Angeles, says The analysis also shows that the WHO cannot track all outbreaks around the world, and so must pick and choose. The team's searchable database could be a useful tool in providing verified information about large outbreaks and documenting the history of infectious diseases, says Mark Smolinski, president of the nonprofit organization Ending Pandemics in San Francisco, California. Having transparent, complementary outbreak reporting systems is an important goal, he adds. The faster we find out there is a real threat anywhere around the world and make that information available, the better off we all are. The database will allow researchers to look at the factors that determine how much money is spent to suppress a specific outbreak or how external circumstances such as conflicts or weather events affect them, says Katz. However, the study notes that DON reports do not mention all known outbreaks in every region. Katz says the WHO could improve the DON report by increasing transparency around how it prioritizes the thousands of notifications it receives, creating more specific criteria for an outbreak's inclusion, and adding information about contextual factors such as climate hazards or outbreaks in animal populations. A spokesperson for the WHO said it is drafting a publication detailing its decision-making process and criteria for DON reports, as well as restructuring its website to make the reports easier to search. The agency adds that it standardized the structure and format of the DON report in 2021, after the period that Katz's study analyzed. WHO is a learning organization, and this extends to DON, the WHO wrote in a statement. Meanwhile, Daily Mail reported COVID isn't over yet. But scientists fear the next pandemic is already lurking just around the corner waiting to pounce. Deadly diseases like Ebola and Nipah, which kill up to 75% of people they strike, are two of the biggest threats. Others, pathogenic hazards, which could theoretically sweep the world if given the opportunity, include bird flu, Crimean Congo fever, CCHF, and the plague. UK health officials are constantly monitoring the threats around the planet in order not to be caught off guard. The UK Health Security Agency UKHSA list, updated this week, includes 15 of the most frightening infectious diseases. These are known as high-consequence infectious diseases, HCID. For a pathogen to be given this category, it typically has a high fatality rate and requires an official, organized response to ensure it is managed effectively. Because symptoms are often difficult to recognize, the list breaks the data down country by country and shows if human cases have been spotted. Yet, it warns that locally acquired HCIDs can re-emerge in countries where they were previously eradicated if the necessary transmission factors are present. But in the same fashion, for countries where the only supporting evidence of a HCID is human serology, the study of blood, the true risk may be lower and the data should be interpreted with caution, UKHSA advised. We'll be right back. The data was created to allow health professionals to assess the infection risk to each country, but it is also publicly available for anyone to access online. These were H5N1, H7N9, and H5N6. For decades, scientists have warned that the disease is the most likely contender for triggering the next pandemic. Experts say this is because of the threat of recombination, which could see a deadly strain of bird flu merge with a transmissible seasonal flu. Crimean Congo fever, CCHF, severe fever with syndrome, SFTS, SARS, and the plague accounted for the final four HCIDs in different countries. SFTS, or severe fever with syndrome, is a disease transmitted by bites from a certain group of virus-carrying ticks. It triggers symptoms including severe fever, vomiting, and diarrhea. Crimean Congo fever, CCHF, is a viral disease which is mainly transmitted by ticks, which can prove fatal for up to 40% of cases. The Ebola-like disease shares similar symptoms at the start of infection, including muscle ache, abdominal pain, a sore throat, and vomiting, among numerous others. Severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, is a viral respiratory disease caused by a SARS-associated coronavirus. It is the earlier, more deadly cousin of SARS-CoV-2, commonly known as COVID, which first originated in China in 2002.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The United States is intensifying efforts to counter China's strong and positive presence in Africa. The U.S. is pursuing an anti-China narrative in Africa as an extension of its global confrontation with China, however. African officials insist that ties with China are beneficial to the continent.
I really appreciate this partnership, the growing partnership between the African Union and the government of China. And I had the pleasure to be responsible about the part of the partnership that relates to health and to social development. And in many areas in my portfolio, I came across a very recognized achievement between the two of us.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. The first segment of our show today is focusing on the intense rivalry between the United States and China in Africa, which has its roots back to the Cold War. We're asking, why are African countries rejecting U.S. pressure and embracing China? In the second part of our show, we shall look at the Israeli regime's continued infiltration of Africa, this time through normalization of ties with Sudan. The people of Sudan have come out to condemn any normalization with the Israeli apartheid regime. So, will the regime in Khartoum listen to the masses? Stay with us for answers from our experts, and you can be part of this conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
China-US face-off in Africa. Over the past few decades, China-Africa cooperation has met the urgent development needs of most African countries. Driven by the Belt and Road Initiative, China-Africa cooperation in infrastructure has seen a boost in critical transport infrastructure across the continent. On the other hand, in recent months, high-ranking U.S. officials have visited Africa, with Washington signaling its return to Africa with these trips. But what is the real intention of a renewed U.S. interests in Africa? Is Washington really interested in the promotion of trade ties with Africa? Or are these visits an attempt to arm twist the continent to downgrade ties with China?
South Africa's International Relations Minister, Dr. Naledi Pandor, has expressed concern about the current tension between the U.S. and China and its impact on Africa.
With reference to the United States and China, all of us are familiar with the trade disputes that there have been. One of them would be with respect to Huawei, which is a company that telecoms companies in South Africa do have relations with in terms of both chips production and components. So the view that if there's a conflict with China, everybody else must join in is a very worrying one. And of course, China and the United States of America are the two largest economies of the world. And when they're trading together in a stable manner, all of us are able to have our economies stable. But once there's a rift, we are all affected because they're so big.
Well, to discuss the U.S.-China face-off in Africa, we have contacted Chindo Shu, a senior fellow, Pangol Institution and political analyst. Thanks for your time today. Now, why have most African countries embraced ties with China despite warnings from Western neocolonial powers to keep off Beijing?
Well, this is a good question, actually. You know, a lot of Western scholars or commentators, the politicians, they don't really understand the nature of China-African relationship. You know, it goes back to the 1950s or even earlier. There's a Chinese support to African movement of national independence from colonial rules, you know, from Western, by Western countries. And there's also African support to the new China, so-called, which was founded in 1949, the People's Republic of China, to return to the UN and regain its legitimate seat at the UN and also at the UN Security Council as one of the permanent members of the UN Security Council. So in China, you know, we were taught since very young, you know, we owe a debt to African countries for their support, diplomatic support to the new China and to the regain of the international status within the UN system.
China is the leading manufacturer of lithium-ion batteries in the world. The United States is also very much in the race for lithium deposits in Africa in a bid to overtake China, which has gone a step further by establishing lithium processing plants in countries like Zimbabwe. This is in line with policies of African countries that now want to add value to their minerals instead of exporting raw or unprocessed natural resources. The U.S. appears intent on confronting China and stopping the country's development projects in Africa.
I think, you know, the U.S. policy on Africa is not really about their relationship with Africa. Their priority is to take on China or Russia. And they think the Chinese presence in the African continent is too large or too strong for them to accept. In that sense, they take African continent or African countries somehow as their vassal states, you know, they should serve the interests of the Washington instead of working for themselves. This is, you know, in a sense, the mentality, a colonial mentality. Somehow they don't respect the sovereignty, the sovereign ability to make decisions based on their own national interests of African countries. The U.S., in the second sense, they are more or less is forcing African countries to pick side between China, Russia, and on the other side, Washington.
China's foreign minister, Qin Gang, recently visited the African Union and said Africa needs solidarity and cooperation rather than confrontation. He pointed out that no country or individual has the power to force African countries to pick sides. Africa should be a stage for international cooperation and not an arena for major force rivalry. On the other hand, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin warned African leaders at a summit that China and Russia risked destabilizing the continent. Now, it's quite clear that unlike China, the U.S. is hostile and confrontational in its approach in Africa. Do you agree?
I think, you know, if you look at the U.S. overall policy on Africa, their policy or their priority is to take on China, is to overcompete China instead of doing business on equal footing with African countries, which is what China is doing. From Chinese perspective, it's really about the business, you know, Chinese investment, you know, in countries and regions where China sees fit, which usually is a win-win situation. You know, China will benefit from such a deal, and such a deal will benefit the regional countries. Because if you don't do that, if you don't follow this win-win policy or win-win principle, and your trade and investment won't be sustainable, because people will see if you benefit from such a deal and I'm losing, and then they will discontinue the operation or the cooperation with you. So it's that simple.
Well, the so-called China's debt trap in Africa is a narrative trap imposed on China and Africa by Western powers. China says its projects in Africa have contributed to Africa's development and the improvement of people's lives. An African expert speaks here on the debt trap propaganda.
The debt trap issue has always been a political, it has always been a political slander. A third of African debt is owed to asset managers, private banks, and all that. But interestingly, the West has loudmouthed. The monopoly of global media means they could shout from the rooftops and get everybody listening.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, in a recent visit to Africa, once again repeated claims by Western officials that China is creating a debt problem in the continent.
First of all, there's a debt issue. I think, you know, the international community acknowledged that. That includes the U.S. and that includes China. All countries acknowledge, you know, there's a debt issue with the developing countries. In some situation, it's a serious issue. So if we go, you know, into detail about the problems, about, you know, what are the causes for this debt problem, the U.S. policy is absolutely one of them. Instead of blaming China, and the U.S. probably should take a careful look at their own policies, including their role on the Ukraine war, and also their, you know, biting sanctions on Russia, and also their constant raise of interest rates. And lastly, I would add that, you know, U.S. is not really in a position to talk about the debt problem of other countries, because they have a much larger debt problem, and which is looming. They are asking the Congress to increase the ceiling, so-called ceiling, basically, so that it will allow them to borrow more from countries like China, like Japan.
Late last year, 49 out of the 55 member state African Union were invited to Washington to attend the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. While African countries need support to fill the deficit caused by various challenges, including the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, African experts insist that Africa wants ties based on mutual respect and not the Big Brother influence projected by Washington.
Last year's U.S.-Africa summit was cited as an example of Washington trying to catch up with Beijing in Africa. Now, did Biden succeed in his objective during the summit?
Their purpose of developing relationship with African countries is not really about their bilateral relationship. It's only because they see, oh, China is developing relationship with African countries rapidly, or Chinese presence in African countries is strong, Chinese trade with African countries is the largest, and the Chinese investment in African countries is the largest. So there's a sense of urgency. Oh, we need to do something to keep down the Chinese development, or to create some setback probably on China's relationship with African countries. That's why they see the necessity of dealing with African countries, of having this such like summit. I would say itself not, you know, it's not for the African countries, it's not for bilateral relationship, it's all for competition with China or confrontation with China.
Well, some analysts believe that African countries could use the ongoing rivalry between the United States and China to advance their own interests. Now, what should African leaders do to ensure that the interests of the continent are secured?
Yes, good question again. I think for African countries, it's really about to remain independent, to remain sovereign in terms of making decisions. Always starting from their own national interests when they deal with powers, you know, big powers in particular, like the US, EU, China, Russia, etc. And also, you know, don't be pressured by Washington or Brussels into submission and to make policies to serve the interests of Washington or Brussels instead of their own interests. That's a key point. That is, you know, when they deal with other countries, they deal with on equal terms, and the I would say there's is justifiable for them to demand equality and also respect and a mutual benefit from other countries. And secondly, I think, you know, very important is related to the first point. That is, they should not be used as tools in this geopolitical game against. Certain countries like China and Russia.
Very well put there. African countries must reject being used as geopolitical tools by Western powers against countries such as China and Russia. I would like to thank our guest, Chindo Shu, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution. Let's now take a short break before our next topic, which is on how the military regime in Sudan has betrayed the masses in this country by normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. Stay with us.
Betrayal in Sudan.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The military regime in Sudan, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has moved to finalize a deal normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. Now, this comes after Israeli regime's foreign minister Eli Cohen visited Sudan early February, where he met General al-Burhan.
The people of Sudan have traditionally supported the liberation of Palestine and therefore reject any normalization deal with the Israeli apartheid regime, which is occupying Palestine and continues to commit atrocities and war crimes against Palestinians.
To discuss how the Sudanese military regime has betrayed its people and Palestinians by normalizing ties with the Israeli regime, we have contacted Elijah Magnia. He's a journalist and political analyst. Thanks for your time, sir, today. Now, do you think Sudan's military leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, depends on U.S. and Israeli support to remain in power, and this situation has compelled him to normalize ties with the Israeli regime?
I think al-Burhan, the Sudanese provisional leaders of Sudan today, is really looking forward to remain in power and not to pass on the authority to a civilian government. And for that, he needs an international recognition And in more specifically, he needs a Western and an Arab recognition. So by approaching Israel, he is building a good connection with the Israelis. He's earning the support of the Americans, and Israel has already good connection with the Emiratis, with the Bahraini, and also with Saudi Arabia. So in making this move, he creates good relationship with the Arab because he needs their money, and with the Americans because he doesn't want them to attack him and call for a regime change in Sudan. And this is why I think he's going to officially normalize with Sudan, even if the population disagree with him.
Sudanese protesters have staged rallies to express their outrage and reject the North African country's decision to move forward with normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The Al-Burhan regime is ignoring demands of the masses that have for decades supported the liberation of Palestine.
Sudan is not alone in this. We have seen during the Qatar World Cup how all the Muslims and Arab citizens that came to Qatar refused any contact with the Israelis. So it is not only Sudan the Sudanese leadership that has a big gap between the leadership and the population. All the Arab countries who normalize with Israel ignored the will of the population.
The masses in Sudan have been holding various protests against the regime in Khartoum over the U.S. and Israeli-backed Al-Burhan military regime.
When we take to the streets every day and people die every day, it's not for nothing. It's for change. It's for a civilian government, a democratic government that protects the rights of people. It is our right to protest. The military will not rule us. This country is supposed to be a civilian democratic country.
Can the anti-Israeli protests and the anti-dictatorship protests turn into a major movement to topple the Al-Burhan regime?
Well, we haven't seen a major protest in Sudan enough to turn the or to create a danger to Al-Burhan's leadership, because he had the army on his side, and because he has all the different part of the army protecting him. This is why the civilian population is not capable of standing against the army until now, unless there is something major that's happening in Sudan.
Sudan is a strategic country in the region. There is concern that the Israeli apartheid regime will use this country to infiltrate African countries and further meddle and spread instability across the region.
Of course, the Israelis have been established in the African continent since 1960s, and they had a good relationship with over 30 countries. However, after the behavior of the Israelis in the exodus of the Palestinians, most African countries, particularly the Muslim countries, cut their relationship with Israel. And now Israel is starting to return to Africa and is using its relationship with Egypt, with the Arab world, particularly with the Emiratis that are also present in Africa, and by expanding slowly to Sudan, having leaking that it has good relationship with Saudi Arabia, to convince the African country to regain the relationship with Israel as it was in the 60s.
Chad, like its neighbor, Sudan is ruled by a military dictatorship and has also normalized ties with the Israeli apartheid regime. Now, first, do you think Israel has a role in suppressing democracy in Chad, just like it's doing in Sudan?
Indeed, Chad is a very important country for Israel. Maintaining good relationship with Chad, particularly after the new president seized the power, is very important for Israel, and the Israelis are supporting the Chad president in technology, intelligence, and with all the equipment needed for the president of Chad and the power in Chad, the militaries, to consolidate their strength over the population. This is why Israel is telling the authority in Chad that it has a lot to offer for them, and the military are accepting it.
Chad is also rich in minerals such as uranium. The Israeli regime is believed to be infiltrating this country to plunder its minerals and especially uranium for its nuclear weapons program.
Well, that's a good point. Chad is not only rich in uranium, but it is rich in gold, in diamond, and so many other minerals. This is why Israel is interested in Chad, because it is on the border with Libya and on the border with Egypt, with Sudan, with Niger, with Nigeria. It is also a presence for the Israeli to expand to all of Africa.
Israeli weapons are being used to further inflame civil wars in Africa. A report issued by a panel of experts appointed by the UN Security Council to study the civil war in South Sudan says weapons manufactured by Israel Weapon Industries have been used by warring parties in this East African country.
Is the Israeli apartheid regime really concerned about the stability of African countries, especially considering the fact that its weapons have been used to inflame civil wars in the continent?
Israel is not concerned about the stability of Africa. Israel is concerned about being present in Africa. Israel can see how the Russian, the Chinese, the Egyptian, the Turks are in Africa, particularly in Chad and in other countries. It has excellent relationship with Nigeria. It's trying to improve the relationship with Niger. This is why the Israelis are present in Africa more than ever, because there is a lot of wealth and minerals and natural resources in Africa. So it is not about the stability of Africa, because in both cases, stability or instability, the Israelis always profit from being present there, particularly when they are part and instigator of the instability in any country they establish themselves in.
There you have it. The Israeli apartheid regime does not care about the stability of Africa, and it's actually infiltrating the continent to plunder its resources. I'd like to thank our guest, Elijah Magnia, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
How the blockaded Gaza Strip looks like and how its residents deal with the hardships in the besieged area is hard to describe. Every day is a new tragic story which the Zionist regime has imposed on innocent Palestinians. However, the fabricated regime of Israel is getting close to its end. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "This past August, Ahmad Amir, 34, stood atop the wreckage of a residential building in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun, in the square